From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a live conversation with the author Ruta Sepetys, whose new novel is The Fountains of Silence, published by Philomel Books. Here's a little information about the novel. It's Madrid, 1957. Under the fascist dictatorship of General Francisco Franco, Spain is hiding a dark secret. Meanwhile, tourists and foreign businessmen flood into the country under the welcoming guise of sunshine and wine. Among them is 18-year-old Daniel Matheson, the son of a Texas oil tycoon, who arrives in Madrid with his parents, hoping to connect with the country of his mother's birth through the lens of his camera. He meets Anna, whose family's interweaving obstacles reveal the lingering grasp of the Spanish Civil War, as well as chilling definitions of fortune and fear. Daniel's photographs leave him with uncomfortable questions amidst shadows of danger. He is backed into a corner of decisions to protect those he loves. Lives and hearts collide, revealing an incredibly dark side to the sunny Spanish city. Ruta Sepetys is an internationally acclaimed number one New York Times best-selling author of historical fiction, published in over 60 countries and 40 languages. She's considered a crossover novelist, as her books are read by both teens and adults worldwide. Her novels Between Shades of Gray, Out of the Easy, and Salt to the Sea have won or been shortlisted for more than 40 book prizes and are included on more than 60 state award lists. Between Shades of Gray was adapted into the film Ashes in the Snow, and her other novels are currently in development for TV and film. Winner of the Carnegie Medal, Ruta is passionate about the power of history and literature to foster global awareness and connectivity. She has presented to NATO, to the European Parliament in the United States Capitol, and at embassies worldwide. Ruta was born and raised in Michigan and now lives with her family in Nashville, Tennessee. But right now, she is sitting on the line waiting for me to stop talking and introduce her. So I am happy to do so. Ruta, welcome to Write the Book. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's always such a nice thing to hear your voice once I've said that. It's like, oh, good, they're there.
I'm here.
That's great. And welcome. We're so happy to have you on the show. So, Ruta, I wanted to start out by asking how much you knew about Franco and the history of Spain in the 20th century before you began this book.
I actually knew very little, and that was one of the things that inspired me to dig deeper into this time period. I toured in Spain for my first novel that was published in 2011, and the readers in Spain, they were so compassionate toward the hidden history in my novel and those who experienced it, that it prompted me to ask about their history, and they assured me it was much too difficult, and it was much too painful. Right. And then when I looked into it and began speaking to people, there were some people who told me, oh, I love Spain. I visited Spain. Remind me, who's Franco? And that really surprised me. Yeah. That really surprised me, right? Because these dictators, Hitler and Stalin, Mussolini, we know these names because we teach these names. But why don't we know more about Franco?
Right. Right. And to some extent, I think we don't know more about Franco because we never fought him, right? I mean, he stayed out of World War II more or less, not altogether. But then he was very open to America at a certain point after the war ended. And that's also part of what this book is about. Do you want to talk a little bit about that history, that sort of... Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Yes, definitely. When I started writing the book, this was definitely a more challenging project for me because my other books contain threads of my own personal family history.
Right.
So I felt like I could write those stories from the inside out. But if I was going to write about Spain, I am not Spanish, nor do I speak Spanish. So I knew I would have to write from the outside in. And to your point, in my research, I realized that although this dictatorship kept Spain so isolated and that many of the Western European countries wanted nothing to do with Franco, there was a country that was doing business with Franco, right. And it was the United States. And that fascinated me. And so I started digging into research, and that's where I got my foothold for the story, from the outside in, an American in Spain during the 1950s.
Right. Now, there's this great line of dialogue. It's actually pretty far into the novel, but it struck me. One of your characters says, images are powerful. They convey truth. And I thought that it was really interesting that you chose photography for your protagonist. Do you want to talk a little bit about developing Daniel's character and making him a photographer?
Thank you for asking that. And I think, you know, images are powerful, and also corresponds with the fact that history has many angles, doesn't it?
Sure.
There are many, many angles to history. And something that really struck me as I was researching The Fountains of Silence, I did a lot of archival photography research. There were a lot of photos of the Spanish Civil War and of the dictatorship. And it really made an impression on me. When we're looking at photography, and even for your listeners, I'd like them to keep in mind that when you're looking at photography, even of your own family, we have to ask what lies outside the frame.
Mm-hmm.
Because as I was researching in archives, I came across photos. For example, I came across a photo of a young boy, maybe 8 years old, who was holding a weapon larger than his body. And to me, I created this narrative instantly. Oh my goodness, you know, child soldiers,
right.
You know, post-Spanish Civil War in Spain. The story to me was very clear. But then as I was researching further, I found photographs from the same scene, but a different angle. And in one of the photographs, there is the child with the weapon larger than his body, but hanging in the left-hand upper corner was a movie camera. So all of a sudden, the narrative went from child soldiers in Spain
right.
to, oh, they were shooting movies in Spain.
Right.
Those are very different stories. And so I thought, what lies outside the frame? And, you know, as writers, we're familiar with this term, and as readers, an unreliable narrator.
Yes.
And so to create Daniel, the character, I thought, what if we have an unreliable observer? Because as tourists, when we visit another country or even another state, aren't we in some ways kind of an unreliable observer? We land in the city and whatever narrative is thrust at us, for example, I live in Nashville, and when you land at the airport, it says Music City, USA. Well, there's a lot more to Nashville and the state of Tennessee than Music City. And so I thought about Daniel, what would this be like for a young, impressionable guy
right.
who's just been given a camera for his graduation gift, and he lands in Madrid full of energy, and he's inquisitive, and he wants to connect with the country of his mother's birth, and he does so through his lens. But is that the real story? Daniel's very inspired by the war photographer Robert Capa. And I did look at a lot of Capa's photography during my research, because he did quite a bit in Spain. So
yeah.
So it was sort of that interest in photography that led me to create the character of Daniel.
Yeah. Well, I do want to ask you about your research. You must have done an enormous amount of research. The book has these wonderful epigraphs in between each chapter that come out of your research sources, I think, that kind of give us a sense of the work that you did and the truth to these stories. So do you want to talk a little bit about what you did for research?
Yes, and honestly, research is my favorite part of the whole thing. I mean, I have to actually tell myself, okay, stop researching. You need to write now, Ruta. And so I spent 7 years researching the novel.
Right.
And throughout those 7 years, some of the research was in Spain. I rented an apartment in Spain.
Okay.
And some of the research was in Texas, because that's the other location where Daniel and his family are from. And the research was not only just in archives and on the ground and walking the path of the characters, but I interviewed countless people who lived through this time period that I was writing about. And it was through those interviews that my characters came to life, that I pulled threads from those interviews. And so the characters are really composites. But it was, to your point, when I was researching in some of the presidential archives and the diplomatic archives, the U.S. was, as we said, was doing business in Spain. We had a lot of diplomats over there with their families. And these diplomats had given very lengthy oral history interviews. Mm. And some of the information that was revealed in the media archives, in the presidential archives, and in the diplomatic archives, it was so illuminating and shocking and interesting that I decided to put some of those excerpts, the actual excerpts, to request permission and put them in the novel itself. So as the reader's reading, they're not only reading the story, but hopefully they're getting a sense of what truly was going on during the time period.
Yeah. Now, the New York Times gave this book a wonderful review. And one of the things that they said sort of is to your point that people don't know the history of Spain and the history of Franco as much as they know certain other European histories. And so the Times in their review of the book said that these oral histories that you quote provide corroboration and help readers clarify these historical events really did happen. And I thought that was an interesting way of looking at it. And it really did sort of kind of make it more concrete as I read about Daniel and Anna. There's also all of this going on.
I'm so happy to hear that because, you know, you never know. As I'm building this novel, as I said, was definitely my most complex, and ambitious effort yet. But there's this period of suspension once you finish the novel before it's published. You know, oh, should I have done this? Should I have done that? Should I have changed this? And I'm so happy that the readers really enjoy those nonfiction inserts, those news inserts. I'm so happy about that.
Yeah. Well, and I think George Saunders sort of opened up paths for us with Lincoln in the Bardo, making, you know, us be able to kind of interweave lots of different genres into our prose. I'm sure that other people have done it before that, but I thought that was just such an extraordinary novel in this time period. So I don't know. I always enjoy that now so much.
Oh, I think so, too. And I'm so grateful that he did that. A bit of, you know, breaking through so people don't find it perhaps so odd. Yeah. Now, wait, what are these interstitial inserts?
Exactly. Yeah. I wondered, as you did your research, were there any particularly surprising resources that you came across or plot changing discoveries where you were like, aha, this is how this is all going to, you know, work out?
Definitely plot-changing discoveries pertained to some of my interviews of the true witnesses and what they told me, particularly the plight of the young people during the Spanish Civil War and post-Civil War period. Children whose parents opposed Franco or fought against Franco during the Spanish Civil War were particularly in peril. Mm-hmm. And I was unaware of that, that after the Spanish Civil War, Franco wanted to rid the country of what he considered the red gene. And some of the children whose parents had perished, these young kids were sent to awful institutions. And I sat with adults who are now in their, you know, late 80s, and the pain that they still endure from that experience. It was something I hadn't planned on putting in the novel. And then I decided, absolutely, I have to put this in the novel. This is representative of so many people. Also people who had no idea what happened to their parents or where they were buried. The theme of silence was something that came up as I was writing the novel. After the Spanish Civil War, people from families who had opposed Franco, they didn't dare speak. And that inspired the title through that research.
Right, right. Let's see. I want to just get to something more craft-oriented about the book. I love that you're very good at offering character backstory and character development without lecturing us or telling us about who these people are. So one example, just so you'll understand what I'm talking about, we learn very early in the novel, we learn of Daniel's family background through the story of an unpleasant girlfriend who broke up with him. And the line that really stood out to me was, thankfully, it was his Spanish heritage that ended the relationship with Laura Beth. He was, quote, too ethnic. And then in italics, it says, gracias, madre. So, you know, we know that because of his mother, he's Spanish. But we also know about this story about Laura Beth, and you kind of worked those two stories together so that you weren't just sort of telling us his mother's Spanish. I loved that. And I wondered if we can talk a little bit about developing characters and presenting their lives that in a way that makes sense, that doesn't, you know, feel boring on the page.
Just like research, it's something that's so exciting to me, character development, because as you can imagine, writing historical fiction, you know, history provides a framework and a bit of an outline, but in creating the characters, that's where I can, you know, infuse my own creativity. And I absolutely love that. And to me, I want to create characters that feel very dimensional to the reader, because if the characters feel real, then a reader will follow them for 300 pages, holding their hand, feeling their fear.
Right.
And that's suddenly when a statistic becomes a human being. And so I really, for me, I look for those specifics. I say that specificity is authenticity. What do I mean by that? I could say, let's say in this novel, he really loved sports. No, what if I say instead, if I constantly drill towards specifics, to say he loved bullfighting, he wanted to become a bullfighter, then the reader knows so much more, the more specific we can get. And so that's what I try to do with my characters, whether it's revealing former relationships they had with Daniel's case, with Laura Beth, and why Laura Beth broke up with him. I think that also shows the reader something. And so I work very hard, and I don't keep detailed character outlines. I tell people that I'm not a writer, I'm a rewriter. And as I'm rewriting, I'm constantly fleshing out those characters. They become more and more real to me, to the point where I know this is going to sound so creepy, but even when I dream, the characters are speaking in the dream, and I can wake up and I can write out their dialogue longhand. That's how they live. These characters, you know, live with me. And I write the characters as if I'm watching a movie. I can see the characters and I can hear them speaking to each other.
Right. Great. Do you miss them when you're finished with a book?
Oh, that's an understatement. And not only that, I'm so self-indulgent that I often will leave in a little loophole where I can go back and take a character, one of the characters, two of the characters, and thread them into another novel, mm-hmm. because I love them so much and I want to continue with them.
That's great. Now, let's see. I want to talk a little bit about Anna, who's also a very main character in the book. And Anna dreams of travel. This is a quote from the book. Anna dreams of travel, of one day leaving Spain. What lies outside the country's borders is untouchable for families like hers. For decades, Franco has believed that outside influence will corrupt Spain's purity and identity. And I found that so interesting because I know something about Spanish history. And I thought it was very ironic because he worked very hard to abolish regional identity. He wanted to get rid of all the regional languages and all of the regional practices and have Spain be a single entity. So it's interesting that he then didn't want any outside influence coming in to ruin Spain's purity and identity. So that's actually not a question about Anna, but I found that to be a really interesting point.
I did too. And there were so many contradictions, so
yes.
to speak. And to your point, the train tracks in Spain were purposely a different width to control the flow of entries and exits. And he wanted to create pure Spain, noble Spain, but yet he allowed the American movie studios to shoot there. He did a deal with Conrad Hilton, and the very first Hilton Hotel in Europe, it wasn't in Paris, as you might expect. It was opened in Madrid amidst a dictatorship, and he allowed the Texas oil barons to drill there.
Right.
And some of the news inserts that I've included say that, in Madrid, there are more Texans than Spaniards, and it sounds like roundup time in the panhandle. And so it was so interesting that Franco wanted pure Spain, noble Spain, but because of the need for money, he opened Spain up to tourism. And I interviewed a few people who did visit Spain during the dictatorship, and they said that it was so open and to Americans that they didn't even realize that many in Spain were suffering in silence. And
right.
that broke my heart.
Yeah, It is. It's really bizarre the way that people were unaware and all of this was going on. Now, one aspect of the story concerns the repressive police force, the Guardia Civil. And very early in your novel, Daniel encounters the Guardia Civil. So I was wondering if you talked to any members of them as you wrote the book. They are still a presence in Spain, although I do believe that their reputation has at least improved slightly under Spain's democracy. But I wondered how you researched the Guardia Civil.
Well, like I said, history has many angles. So I researched in different ways. First, I researched people who were children at the time, what their impressions were of this force, not just in Madrid, but in the country. Then speaking to some members who served in the Guardia Civil themselves, and they explained that this was a no-questions-asked type of environment. Remember, there was no freedom of speech. There was no freedom of religion. There were no equal rights. Women didn't have the right to a passport or to open a bank account without special permission. And people accepted what doctors, lawyers, or these, you know, the police force was saying and doing. And so there were conflicting reports, as there always are, and that's why I tried to show a balanced approach. But some people said, oh my goodness, they absolutely ruled with, you know, an iron hand, and others said they were just doing what they were told. And in my research, what was relayed to me was we were doing what we were told, you know, and not many, I didn't, as it, with some of my other novels, let's say with my first novel, when I interviewed people with Soviet secret police, they absolutely did express, you know, that they questioned what they were instructed to do. But in this case, perhaps I didn't interview enough people, but no, they said we did what we were told, period.
I'm sure that
we were obedient.
Yeah, I'm sure that that's what they would say. And if you had talked to more of them, you'd have heard that more times.
Right.
You know, it reminds me a little bit of the stories that are coming off of the border with Mexico. And that reminds me to ask you if you're hearing any feedback from readers about the timeliness of this book, given our politics and the situation, the division in America at this time. And I wondered if you feel that that's a relevant subject. Do you address that specifically when you're talking to young people?
I always address the fact that knowledge of the past gives context to the present. And if we want to understand where we are now and where other countries are now and what our initiatives are, and really we never have to look too far into history to see that history repeats itself, sadly. And something else that is quite sad is that I read a recent report that stated that history as a college major ranks among the lowest, that young people feel it's no longer an employable major. And for me, that terrifies me. What happens if we lose our historians? What happens if we lose the definitive texts that are created by historians? As an author of historical fiction, my work sits on the shoulders of nonfiction, of academic papers, of witness testimony. So it's scary, but yes, we do. I think that's helpful with students that I meet with to ask, do you see any relation, any context of the present in the past in what you're reading?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember hearing a relevant statistic to what you've just said, and that is that students are studying the sciences less than they used to as well. And I think that what's really up is study of the arts, which is so interesting to me. But we need everybody to be looking at everything. So,
yes, we do. And I think in study of the arts, history plays a role in that, because in most artistic endeavors, an artistic endeavor requires that we learn to dwell within something or someone else. What does that mean? Let's say if you're an actor, you need to be able to dwell within another character, within another human, to be able to look through someone else's eyes and consider their heart. If we don't know the history, that really will interfere with our ability to create art. A lot of great art is created from historical pain or joy, even stories of joy. And so I think that there's a risk to all of various disciplines moving forward if we don't have a firm knowledge of history.
Yeah. Do you mind if I read a few little lines from the book and then we can talk about a larger question?
Sure, please.
Okay, so I have three. First, early in the book, when Daniel asks if she is from Madrid, this is a quote, Anna looks him straight in the eye, she smiles and lies. So that's one. Another one a bit later, we hear from Anna's sister, Julia, that, quote, trouble follows our sister wherever she goes. She's been so quiet lately, I'm worried she's hiding something. And then right after that, is the third example. Their brother Rafa thinks, of course, Anna's hiding something. This is Franco's Spain. They're all hiding something. So I wanted to talk a little bit about building intrigue and suspense, and also the power that secrets have in a narrative, the power that they hold over a reader and make us want to move through the text.
Yes, and as an author, there's a delicate balance that I have to maintain when we deal with secrets, because if I'm giving too much, then that elasticity of suspense that pulls us forward, then I'm ruining it. But if I'm not giving enough, I'm angering the reader. And I know myself that when I read, I'm like, oh, would you stop? You know, just stop baiting me. Just tell me already. And so I really wanted to strike that balance. And I did it not only through plot, but I do it, I spent 20 years working in the music business prior to becoming an author. So my first storytelling experience was in songwriting, and a song is a 3-minute story. And a song, the story in the song is conveyed often through melody and rhythm. And your listeners might not remember one thing I said on the interview. However, tonight they might hear a song on the radio that they haven't heard in 5 years, and they can sing every word to that song. And that's because melody and rhythm make something memorable. Those are powerful tools. So in working with suspense, I never forget that. I read all of my work aloud, listening for rhythm and flow, hoping that it's pulling the reader forward. I write in short sentences and short chapters, which is part of my, which I've heard is an annoying style. And I do that. It's again musical. It's like a staccato rhythm. These are some very heavy subjects. If I need to grab the reader and pull them to the page and keep them there. And so with these various statements that you've just read, some maybe are a rhythmic element. Some are this, like I say, an elasticity that I'm trying to pull you forward. And if you could see my drafts, or if your listeners could see my first draft, they would agree that I'm definitely a rewriter, not a writer. I give myself the courage to fail. And I ask that any of your listeners who are writers or who don't consider themselves writers, they probably are, but they're concerned, oh, I don't know if I could do that. Imagine if you were a performer or an athlete and you could go back to your performance or game and change one thing. Well, as writers, we can do that. We can go back and revise, and we can change lots of things. And so when I'm trying to create a suspenseful scene to pull the reader through, it's more about revision, about nailing the rhythm, word choice, an economy of phrasing in writing suspense. Too many words, nope, it kills it for the reader. So all of those elements, you know, play a role in what I'm trying to do.
Oh, that's great. Thanks for answering that one. I'm just going to break in here and say that listeners, you are listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And I am speaking today with the author Ruta Sepetys about her new book, The Fountains of Silence. If you're enjoying the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and help spread the word. Ruta, I wanted to ask you, this is kind of a more mundane or workaday question, but I'm curious how you stay organized as you work, especially since so much of your work takes place in another time and other places, and I think often with many characters that you probably have to kind of stay on top of. So how do you stay organized? I'm picturing you with a big whiteboard in your office or sticky notes or something.
Well, what I do is when I choose a concept to write about, the first step is that I want to read all of the nonfiction, memoir, testimony, academic research that I can. Because once I travel to the place where the events happened, if I start to interview true witnesses, I want to make sure, out of respect for them and their time, that I am well-versed in the topic. So I do as much of my nonfiction reading at first. And as I'm reading, I'm pulling what I call our emotional hits, or things that stand out to me. And when I start a project, I choose a journal, a blank journal, mm-hmm. and that journal becomes almost a nonfiction companion for my novel. So for each novel I've written, you could look at my journal and it reads almost like a nonfiction account. And it's in that journal that I keep track of, like I say, emotional beats, again, beat coming from my experience in the music industry,
sure.
Character breakdowns, items that I want to weave into the characters. When I'm into the country where I'm researching, what I'll do is I'll create like a Google spreadsheet with different tabs, and whether I'm taking notes by hand or recording into my phone, and then I transcribe the most important things into this spreadsheet so that when I get home, then I have everything in one place and I can look through it and decide what I want to weave into the novel. After I interview someone, I always build in time. I never go from one interview to the next. I always leave myself at least 30 minutes to sit by myself and take down impressions of the interview. And that could be not only what I felt, but what I experienced, where the person was wringing their hands, where they began to cry, where they were visibly uncomfortable, physical descriptions, multi-sensory descriptions. So that's what's going to give my character dimension. And so I have to build in that buffer time, to move from reaction to reflection.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes when people are telling me something, it's so shocking that I'm reacting, but I need to move from reaction to reflection. And at that different altitude, that's when I can really gather all of these details and put together my thoughts to then weave them into the novel.
Okay, great. That's wonderful. Yeah, I had no idea that you had quite so many organizing devices, but that's really helpful because I think I would need that. All right, this is kind of a little bit of an unusual question considering everything else we've been talking about, but I was curious, how do you decide whether or not to include historical figures like Franco as actual characters in your works?
That's a great question, and I agonize over it because I ask these difficult questions. What right do we have to history other than our own? And I'm writing about time periods that I didn't experience. And so, for example, two of my other books that deal with Hitler and Stalin, they are mentioned certainly as an overwhelming force, but they don't appear as characters.
Right.
This is the first novel where actually a dictator, Franco actually appears. We don't hear him speaking, but he appears. He is in the novel. And I agonized over that. But that was inspired by an account that I read and then someone that I interviewed who had this experience of being a journalist on the ground and photographing Franco. And it was fascinating to me, and so I wound it in. But it's quite agonizing for me because I that's why I spend so much time. I really want the books to be authentic, and I fear that sometimes if we put these very well-known villains in the novel, it might actually pull the reader out. And I also feel that we know the villains, because we teach the villains. But we don't know the victims. And so I'm more interested in what could we learn from the victim's story.
It's interesting, though, because it sounds from the way you've described using what you had at your disposal before writing Franco into this book, it sounds almost like another presentation of historical oral history. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like you didn't riff on him. You presented him as he was, as in this historical moment. So that sounds like it's a little more in keeping with what you'd
correct.
Like to do.
correct. And that was, I wasn't making up a moment or just creating a moment where, oh, look, there's Franco. No, I did take an actual documented moment and inserted that into the book. It's difficult with the book that I'm working on. You know, now I won't show the villain. I don't think that an opportunity will present itself in a way that wouldn't seem forced. Mm-hmm. And because these are difficult pieces of history, obscure parts of history, I want to try to create the story in a way that's seamless for the reader, where they're not being beaten over the head with information, or that things feel like an info dump, or I'm inserting, you know, characters and dictators, just to as a check mark, so to speak.
Sure, sure. So I was about to ask that. So what are you writing next?
Oh, I'm always so excited about my new projects, and I have a list of 21 topics that I'd like to write about. But I do want to ask your listeners that to please, if there are topics that you're interested in, this is how I decide what to write next. When people literally write to me through my website and say, have you ever considered this? Or this is an untold story. I wish someone would tell the story. And the story I'm working on now is set in Romania during the 1980s, during the Ceausescu regime. And when I toured in Romania, I fell so deeply in love with the Romanian people. And I've written quite a few novels now about people who were oppressed. And what I found is, let's say in my first novel, Between Shades of Grey, that mm-hmm. told the story of the Baltic people, yes, you know, the Baltic people certainly suffered under the Soviet regime. And fortunately, they had a unity in victimhood. The Lithuanians, the Latvians, and Estonians, they had a unity in their victimhood. In Romania, what I discovered is that this regime was so insidious in this particular brand of nationalistic communism. They pitted the Romanian people against one another, and one in every six people, they were an informer for the Securitate, for the secret police. Wow. And so there was no unity, and people didn't know who they could trust. They had to speak in whispers, even in their own home. Husbands were informing on wives. Children were recruited, and unknowingly, they were informing on their parents and grandparents and teachers, and it had disastrous consequences. So now I'm writing about these young people who were recruited as teenage spies, and what disastrous effects it had.
Wow, that sounds the background sounds a little bit like China under Mao, but yeah, that sounds horrible and frightening. Yeah. Okay, well, Ruta, I have one last question for you, and I'm not going to spoil anything about the end of your novel, I promise. But I wondered if you can offer advice to listeners who are writers for designing an ending that suits the subject matter as well as the individual story that you've chosen to tell. So in your case, a lot of your fiction is historical. So you carry a lot of responsibility on your shoulders as you present individual stories like those of Daniel and Anna. So finding an ending that kind of suits both the smaller story and the larger historical context, do you have any advice, or does that ring any bells for you?
Oh, it definitely rings a lot of bells. And for me, the first question, the first thing that I'm going to aim for is an ending that leaves the reader wanting to know more, with a desire to know more, that the first thing they do is they get on the internet and they say, wait, I need to know more about this. What happened? Because these are underrepresented pieces of history, and human beings, in some cases, who feel that the world has forgotten them. Mm-hmm. That is not the case. We just don't know their story. So my first goal is to create an ending that leaves the reader wanting more. And of course, like I said, that's self-indulgent because I have these crazy dreams of writing sequels for all my books that I know will never happen, but I would love to do it. And so that's the first thing. Then the second thing, which is a bit more restrictive, and I have to mention that this is a restriction that I impose upon myself. I don't want writers listening to think that if they are writing historical fiction, that they have to do this. But for me, my question is not what serves the story, but what best serves the history. Mm-hmm. And so in formulating an ending, I have to step outside of myself and take myself out of it, that this is my novel. No, this is history's story. And what type of ending will best serve this history? And more often than not, as I say, history has many angles. So it's an ending that's going to provide a balanced approach without my personal opinion injected, or without my personal family history injected, because I was connected to some of the other topics that I wrote about.
Right.
So though, that's really what the two things. I want to leave the reader wanting more with the ending, and I want something that serves the history.
Fantastic. That's great advice. Now, before we say goodbye, I wonder if you can share the best place for listeners to learn more about your work if they would like to.
Yes, I have a complex name that's hard to describe over the radio. So I also have a URL that's very easy for my website, historyishiding.com. If you go to historyishiding.com, that takes you to rudisapetes.com, and all my information is there. I'm on Twitter at rudisapetes. I'm on Instagram at rudisapetesauthor. I'm on Facebook at rudisapetes. But if you go to historyishiding.com, you can find me in all those spots. You can find additional information on my books and videos and discussion guides, all sorts of stuff.
That's fantastic. You're making me laugh because my first name is very difficult. And so my website is shelaughswithoutus.com, because if you take she laughs and take out the U and the S, you have my first name.
Perfect. So you know my pain.
I do.
And you know, with my name. Yes.
Listen, thank you so much for speaking with me, Ruta. It's been really fun.
Oh, I've loved it. Thank you so much for having me. And again, I want to impress upon your listeners, give yourself the courage to fail. If that is something that's keeping you from bringing that old draft up again, from trying again, or from even taking a first shot at it, failure is a prerequisite to success.
The interview you just heard was with the author Ruta Sepetys. Her name is spelled R-U-T-A and then S-E-P-E-T-Y-S. And her new book is The Fountains of Silence, published by Philomel Books. Today's Write the Book prompt is to write about a disempowered person who takes at least a small risk to change his or her circumstance or to improve the situation of someone else. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell friends and family. Next week, I'm going to air a recording that I made of a recent panel discussion called Local Ladies of Horror. I moderated the panel, which took place at the T.W. Wood Gallery in Montpelier. It featured former Write the Book guests Micaiah Begalt, Jennifer McMahon, and Susan Z. Ritz. And it was a lot of fun, and the panel shared insights into their approaches to writing suspense, mystery, and, as the title suggests, horror. So if any of these are your genre, you might want to tune in next week for the Local Ladies of Horror panel that I took part in. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.